where he, I see him start getting kind of loose and kind of pumped. Mm-hmm. And that's the state you want them in to go remember a flyer, is like pretty relaxed and loose. So I'm talking to him. Yeah, that's it. Okay, where's that flyer? And I thought, okay, last bird in the 2019 National. Yes. Put my hand in, said his name. And he just charged out there and made one little check, a little bit, like under the arc of the bird, and then went right in this bird. Ugh. He went right out there and knew where it was. Came flying home with it. And I was just ecstatic, because at that point, I don't know if we win. There's 9 more dogs to run. You don't know anything. The thought is, we did our best. And if our best wasn't the best of the field today, that's fine. That happens a bunch of weekends. Like, where I know that's as good as Fox can do, but it wasn't, we weren't the best in 4 series. We were just the best on one bird, or, you know, whatever the case may be. But it's a good feeling to know you left nothing behind.
Hey, bird dog babes. My name is Courtney Vashton, and I am obsessed with all things bird dogs. And I'm here with you to share the stories, experiences, knowledge, and opinions from the women and a few guys in the industry that are killing it. I'm a Wisconsin girl living in a Montana world. I'm mom and 2 incredible kiddos, wife and occasional assistant to a pro gun dog trainer, traveling the U.S. talking about canine nutrition while hunting, breeding, and competing with my German wire hair pointers and Bronco Italianos. As someone who started hunting later in life because I wanted to give my dogs the opportunity to do what they were bred to do, I'm here to help inspire, educate, and connect women to get their bird dogs out in the field and experience a bond like no other. So pour yourself a glass of wine and get ready to be challenged and encouraged while you learn. This is the Bird Dog Babe Podcast. Oh man, you guys are amazing. I am so incredibly grateful for all the positive feedback I received last week after the launch of this podcast. To celebrate, I'm doing a giveaway. Who doesn't like free stuff, right? All you have to do is subscribe to this podcast if you haven't already, rate it, and write a review. Then go to Instagram and tag at least one friend and let them know why they should listen. Be sure to hashtag BirdDogBabe. We will choose a winner on Friday, April 24th. So again, subscribe, rate, review, and then post to Instagram and tag a friend who would enjoy hearing this podcast. Let's connect, inspire, and share our passion.
Hey, Mom, don't forget, hashtag BirdDogBabe.
This is part 2 of my chat with Lauren Hayes, the winner of the 2019 National Open Retriever Championship with her Labrador Retriever, Fox. Today, Lauren gets into the intense and emotional week of the championship. She has such incredible detail, it makes you feel like you're right there with her. We also discuss the method that Lauren used to choose Fox as her next competitive field trial dog, or perhaps I should say the method that Fox used. What kind of dog does it take to be competitive at the national level? It's not easy to come by a dog like Fox. One that is loaded with personality and an undeniable zest for life. He has a pedigree loaded with promise. He has a perfect balance of confidence, work ethic, ability, and mostly heart. Add to that a bond based on trust between dog and a talented owner, trainer, handler like Lauren Hayes, and you have yourself a national champion. Now, let's get after it. Thank you to our sponsor, Dakota 283, unparalleled protection for traveling to and from your favorite hunting spot. Dakota 283 kennels are a premium quality rotomold mold with recessed handles on top for convenient and safe tie down. It makes it easy to lift up into the truck. I love the secure door frame with high security locks, so I know my dogs are safe when I need to stop for fuel. An added bonus are the drain holes in the back, which make cleaning a breeze when your dog has been run hard and put away wet. Head over to Dakota283.com and enter promo code BIRDDOGBABE for a 10% discount to all my listeners.
So tell me about your series. Tell me about
Foxes, you're in Fox's day together. Weekend.
Ugh. Entire week. Entire week.
It's oh my gosh. It's an entire week? Okay.
Yes. Yes. Oh, yes.
The nerves. I can't imagine.
It is the most adrenaline marathon roller coaster you can imagine. And it really, I had somebody ask me like, oh, well, does it get, you know, is it, or do you feel a lot better than your first national, in which I ran in 2012? I'm like, well, yeah, I definitely feel better than I did in the first one, but I am not really any less nervous. Like there's like a maximum nervous level that I get to. And I achieve that every single time I run national. So it's like, I can't get any more nervous than I was before, like the eighth series or the first series is always nerve wracking. But so let's see, Fox first series was a double and he did a nice job on it. He got a long pheasant flyer, a long rooster pheasant flyer. But he drilled his, and he had a little hunt on it, just very small area hunt, and then drilled the memory bird, the short retired. And that was an interesting series. One thing I got to say about this national, those judges did not have the easiest grounds. I don't know if you've ever seen the grounds in California.
I haven't.
But they'd be hard to judge on. They'd be hard to come up with fair and challenging tests. And I wouldn't. I'm saying this about the last time I ran in California, which was 2015 with Slider, and 2019 with Fox. All of those judges did a good job. And I went out in the ninth series in 15. So it's still, no matter how you do, that's a hard place to judge. So I got to give them a lot of credit for that. And then Fox is looking at me. What, are we talking about the Nashville? Yeah, you remember that? That was fun, huh?
You're telling my story.
Yeah, he's looking.
He's like, don't forget the good parts about me.
Right. He's like, get back to me. Stop talking about the judges. Talk about me. And then the second and third series were blinds, a land blind and a water blind. And Fox has always been really good at the initial line on a blind. So he's always been, if you can get him to look at an exact spot, and I mean exact, he will go there. And he's always been that way. Like I had to get to where I could read his eyes perfectly to capitalize on that, but he's very straight and he's very fast. So his initial lines on those blinds, like if he and I are in sync, that he's hard to beat on an initial line on a blind, because if I can see, okay, it's at that bush and I'm like, and that bush is 350, 400 yards away, but I can tell he's looking, I mean, as close as I can tell he's looking at that bush and I say back, there's a very good chance he's going to run straight to it. Like he's just straight and fast. So on those two blinds, he was in the mood to work with me on the mat and look where I asked him to look and go there. And he ran two really nice blinds. And I only kind of bring that up because I heard from someone later that one of the reasons he won was his initial lines on the blinds, which I've never heard that in a national before. So it's kind of unique, like I've just never heard somebody bring that up as part of what went into a winning decision on a national. But initial lines on the blinds were good. Fourth series was a water triple. He did a really good job on that. Fifth series was a land quad with, let's see, three birds retired and two flyers. He had a hunt there on one of the birds, not way out of the area, not a wild hunt, but that was where I would say of the entire national, his most significant hunt was. I was nervous to run that. That one was knocking him out left and right. Very hard, a quad where, you know, if you guys run marks or don't, you know, the dog is sitting on the mat and four different gun stations. So first, guys step up and shoot a big rooster flyer. And the dog is just sitting there next to you. And then without, you know, you can't touch the dog, you can't talk to the dog while the marks are going off, but you can move. And the dog needs to be able to move with you in very subtle movements. We're not talking big steps. We're talking like eye clicks. So then he shoots that flyer and it's very exciting. So the dog wants to keep staring at where that fresh flyer just hit the ground. But then they shoot a bird over here to the right and the dog's got to watch that one. And then they shoot another bird to the right and they got to watch that one. And then you got to pull them even harder over to the right and they shoot another flyer. And so there's a lot going on in the seconds where you call for the birds, you know, you show the dog the guns and you give the judges the cue that you're ready for those birds to start being shot.
Mm-hmm.
There's, if the dog isn't working with you in those moments, you're done. Like you, because I can't help him look where he needs to be looking if he's going to insist on staring just at the flyer, or if he's going to creep, you know, inch out away from me and only want to watch one bird. I can't leave the mat, so I can't help him. If the dog is, if you're not really working together as a team during something like that where there's a quad, it's just going to be very hard to do a nice job. So we work hard on line manners for exactly that reason. So that was the fifth, and we got through it. And, you know, you never know. Nationals are funny. Callbacks are funny because you know, and now I think we're on Wednesday. So this started on a Saturday and they're whittling down dogs after every series. And now we're probably, by the time we're at the fifth series, I think we're on Wednesday. And that's the first really big cut they make. So if you had had a little bit of sloppy work early on, they kind of want to let everybody play for a while. You drove all the way out there, you qualified. Sure. They're typically kind of generous, and these judges were very generous. And but after the fifth series, they say, okay, now we're about to start trying to, like, now we're going to start looking at winners. And if you're not winning or you're not looking really good, if you're doing very average work or you've had a bunch of mistakes, you're gone. Mm-hmm. So I had that hunt and I thought, well, I think my work up to this point's been really clean. So I hope they feel the same way and don't drop me. So when I was back, I was, Glenn and I were super excited. You know, it's like the halfway point and you're exhausted by this point and stressed. And normally you go in between series and go training, but it was kind of hard to get out of that area to train. So we didn't get to do much of that. And every day after the trial, I would just take Fox down to this little bitty city park, which is the only green grass I could find, and put him on a, you know, like a retractable flexi lead and just take a walk and walk around this park with him and throw the tennis ball for him. And I had somebody say, like, what was your secret to like keeping him together all week? I'm like, I don't got a secret. It was like walks in the park and tennis balls. That's all, just to keep our mind right. It's a very hard thing to keep the dog's mind right, as the handler to keep your own mind right. And Bill Eckett taught me so much about that since my first five nationals were with him. He was a master at helping me learn as the handler how to keep myself in the frame of mind that keeps you very sharp and competitive, but not so nervy that you are making mistakes when it really counts. So,
because that travels down to the dog.
Oh, you bet. And
yeah.
Oh, you bet. I mean,
and that's something you can't train for.
Right. Yeah. Because you're never going to be that nervous in training, no matter how hard you try to fake it. So the sixth series was a land blind and Fox had a nice job on that. The seventh series was a very challenging water blind. And he did a good job on that. And then the next big milestone was that eighth series, and it was a water quad. And I have the drone picture of it as my background on my phone, because it was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do with Fox. And And it reminds me, like, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Because I look at that and I remember when I was praying in the holding blind before I ran, it was like, okay, so the first dog that ran it, the day that we started the A series, the first dog did a great job. So everyone's like, oh, well, this won't be that bad. Well, then the next 10 dogs in a row handled or picked up.
Oh, wow.
And this is and they're only going to run 14 dogs that day. And I am now the 12th dog up, and the dog in front of me had run a beautiful national. I'd been behind him the whole time. It was Al Arthur running a dog named Deep. And he, on this wicked little short retired bird they threw onto an island, it was a pheasant. And he gets this dog from the send. He gets the send perfect. Everything about what he did as a handler was perfect. The dog takes off like just the right kind of momentum. Like, he knows it's not a big punch bird. You can see it in his body language. He's running out there. He's ready to start looking for a bird. He gets out on the island, like, and you know all about this, Courtney, from what you do, how critical the wind is. Right. And he puts this dog 2 feet downwind of this bird on the island, and the dog just keeps going. Mm. Can't smell it. And I'm like, well, okay, then this is impossible. If you can have a dog in that position and not get the bird, there is no way to get this bird. There's just something is, because it was a hen pheasant with almost no scent thrown into a big clump of cover that was blocking the scent. And it just looked impossible. So, gosh. And Fox just, we were just in sync. He watched the birds great with me. He wanted to pick them up in the same order that I wanted him to pick them up. And he, you know, came out of the water and got on that island and just kind of like did this pounce and just went up in the air and then just put his nose down in this cover and just pulled the bird straight out and came back with it. Like, it just wasn't even, he didn't even use his nose. Like, it just went, it was like I started crying, and it was only the second bird I had picked up of the four I had to pick up. And one of the judges, Cindy Howard, who's awesome, she goes, no, don't cry. Lord, no crying yet. You have 2 more birds to pick up. Okay.
But you knew, because he like, saw that. Relief. Yeah.
Okay. And
so tell me about those next 2 birds. Were those just quick and clean?
The third one, very quick and clean, actually had a little bit of a wing sticking up. So when he exited the third piece of water he had to exit, he looked and saw it and scooped it up. Mm. And then the long retired was the last one. And he was on this perfect line to the bird. And at the last second, he's way out there. I don't know how far it was. So it was the longest mark, very well retired. He's all the way out there and he's almost to the bird. And there's this bush that's like deep and left of where the guns are. Not much, but a little deep and left. And he just ran over and ran one little loop around the bushes. Like, maybe there's gunners back here. And then, nope, ran right back over and got the bird. So it kind of gave me a heart attack for a second. Because I thought,
oh my gosh,
like, why did you have to go check that bush? But he just had to satisfy his curiosity, didn't you, Fox? Yeah, you scared me on that one.
Buddy. Dogs will be dogs.
Yes, yes, that's so
he
true.
He wanted to keep you alert.
He did a great job of that all week. and so that was like huge relief. And then they ran 1 or 2 more dogs, and they didn't do the test either. And so 2 dogs did it on the first day that they ran it out of, you know, 14. And the next day I just was sitting in the hotel room, like watching the blog that the Retriever News does. And I'm just seeing dog after dog just going down in flames on this thing. And I'm, you know, I'm watching like dogs I've been rooting for and dogs in my training group. And that's the thing about a national, is that it's so hard. It's so hard to even be there that you don't even get that typical, like, I really want to beat you feeling until way, like maybe even not. Like, I don't even know that I really even get that competitive during one. Like, I want to do well, but I'm not like do I know that's the dog to beat? Because there's so much information in those judges' books that you didn't get to see.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not there all day, every day. Right. You're not getting to see it. So you really don't know. You know, you might mm-hmm. see it on the blog, or you might hear that somebody had a good job or a bad job, but there's a lot of unknowns. So I was just sitting there watching these dogs that I know. Fox just had a litter with one of the females that had a great national going, and I think ended up having to handle in the eighth. And which anybody that doesn't know just means on a mark, it's the dog's job essentially to get the bird. So if you have to blow a whistle and give a hand signal or a cast to help the dog get to the bird, it's a huge, huge penalty. So if she, this particular dog had to handle, and I thought, man, this is just eating them up. You know, mm-hmm. we're not going to have any dogs left by the time we get to the ninth series. So they finally did start the ninth. They were running a little short on time. So they went from a quad to a triple, a hard triple. And my brother-in-law was actually the one throwing the long rooster, rooster pheasant flyer in the ninth series. And the dog in front of me had gotten kind of a short flyer. And so, not that he knew, but when it was my turn to go, he was kind of trying to make up for like the last throw being kind of a dud. So he gave it all he's got, and the guy has just an incredible arm on him. So this rooster goes like three counties away, it seemed like. And I was like, oh, that's not good. But Fox marked it really well, and we had a good night. And then it was, let's see, the next, that was the end of the day. Yeah. And the next morning we finished the ninth and went and ran the 10th. And when I saw the 10th series, I thought, oh, they are not done judging us. Like every now and then you run a national where it's been really hard and they got all the answers they need. And the 10th series is more like a showcase. Okay. Like,
how many
almost
dogs did you have
to do it?
How many dogs were still standing in the ninth? Do you remember?
Let's see how many they carried all the dogs that there were two dogs they had to talk about. Were one of them popped and meaning was hunting for the bird and then turned around and sat down without a whistle, which means like the dog kind of quit on the mark. Mm. And there can be extenuating circumstances like the dog heard a gunner talking or the dog heard something, and the judges will give them the benefit of the doubt. And that's what they chose to do in this case was, okay, we think that there was something that caused that. So we're not going to count it as we're going to penalize it as heavily as if the dog had truly just quit hunting. And then there was another dog that had a lot of trouble and had to be handled. And they thought maybe the dog had fallen and tripped in the ditch. So they gave that dog the benefit of the doubt, and they ended up bringing everybody back to the 10th, which is unusual, but I thought was extraordinarily fair, because anytime you're one of those dogs that could have tripped or could have heard a whistle, you just pray that you are going to have a judge that's going to see it that way.
Right.
And I just don't think you go wrong by giving dogs the benefit of the doubt. So let's see how many. 1, 2, 3. So 18, is that right? 7. 15 handlers and 18 dogs.
Okay.
Were in the 10th series. Oh, no, I'm sorry. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 14 handlers and 18 dogs made it to run the last series. And of those, by the time the 10th series was over with, I believe there were six dogs total that had done the entire national without handling clean.
Wow.
So you can be a finalist and have handled still one time. And then in the 10th, you can handle if you need to more than one time, and you'll still be a finalist. It's kind of a, they relax the rule a little bit in the 10th. Yeah. yeah, mm-hmm. it's kind of a 10th series is like no other series you're ever going to run anytime.
Okay. So that's not something that you would have done on the weekends in your regular trials?
Oh yeah, no. Like if, okay. So like a normal 4th series, let's say the last series of a weekend trial, if they threw a quad like they did in the 10th series, like 4 birds or a triple for that matter, and you handle on 2 of them, you blow the whistle and help the dog get to 2 different birds, you are automatically disqualified. In the 10th series, you could blow a whistle and handle on all 4 birds and they will still let you be called a finalist. Just very different. I would have to say it stems from having a lot of respect for a dog that can get to a 10th series. It's so mm-hmm. hard to do that they just want you to finish at that point. But you still can't do something that would disqualify you. Like your dog still can't break. The dog can't leave the line before the judge releases you. The dog can't go back to an old fall. So if they hunted an area, got a bird, brought it back, and then you send them out for a different bird and they go back to that first spot and try to find a second bird in the first spot, you're mm-hmm. automatically disqualified for that. You can't start hunting in one area, leave it and go give up and go try to find a bird in a different area. That's called a switch. Those are all things that you would still be disqualified for in the 10th series of a national, or eat it, you know, if the dog tries to eat the bird or freezes on the bird or some of these things. But oddly, you can double, triple, or quadruple handle. They will let okay. you do that. So if you were to see your dog, like say, hunting in an area for a bird, can't find the bird, and you see your dog start leaving to go try to get a different bird, in the 10th series of a national, you blow that whistle and you put them right back in there. Nope, you better go in and get that bird I told you to get. And that'll right. save you from being disqualified.
Okay.
Whereas a weekend trial, you definitely can't do any of those things. But also if you double handle, you're out. So a little different there.
Yeah.
Yeah, the 10th series was, I think I ran exactly halfway through the pack. Like I ran 9th. Out of 18. And it just, you know, it was just like we were in sync again. Came up to the line. He was all business. I showed him all 4 guns. It was a very, very hard test. And at this point, you know, as my mentor, Bill Eckett, would have said, just, you want to finish this. Like, you don't want to let the dog get into any trouble trying to win. So for example, one of those things I'm talking about, like switching or going back to an old fall, you don't want to sit there and let your dog get in so much trouble on a hunt that you can't save them. And then you're out and you're not even a finalist. So it's kind of this, you go into a 10th series with a very different attitude and outlook than you do any other time. And so at this point, I had heard a couple of rumblings that Fox was in a really good shape to win. And I try to put all that out of my mind and not listen to any of that, because none of it matters and it's just going to get in your head. So yeah, I tried not to think about it, and just we got to the mat. I showed him all the guns. I'm at maximum nervous, you know, I'm all the way up red line nervous. And but you know, as soon as I hit the mat, everything goes away and it's just me and Fox. And I've been like that my whole life, like in competition. Like I'm the worst moment is waiting in the holding blind right before they call me to the line. And then as soon as I'm on the mat, it's like it's just the two of us. And the birds went off and I was watching him really closely, and he watched every bird right to the ground. And so that's your first thing that you need. Your first check in the box is, did my dog see every single bird? Did I do my part on the mat to make sure that he saw every mark? And did he do his part? Was he obedient with me and working with me to where now no matter what happens, at least I know it's not because he didn't see one of these birds. He saw everything. So that's the first check in the box. So he watches all the birds. They give me my number. I send him. He steps on the little duck flyer, which was first, came back. And my plan had been to go get the pheasant flyer, the hen pheasant flyer, which is the next shortest bird, second. And thankfully, he came right back by my side and wanted to look there second. And the order that you pick up marks in is not, the judges can't tell you what order to get them in. So it's always up to the handler. And there's definitely ways that we train, you know, we train consistently in certain ways to determine that order. So usually, for example, we pick up a short bird before we pick up a long bird.
Okay.
But sometimes the dog decides that a certain bird is much more tempting, and they will come back from the last bird thrown, which is the first bird you send for. They'll come back with that and just decide they want this, you know, they want bird B. And your plan had been, well, you're supposed to get bird A.
Right.
And that's where the team aspect of it really comes into play. Because if I know for fact that if I let you go and get bird B, it's going to make picking up bird A really, really, really hard. Then I really need you, even though I know you really want B, I really need you to listen to me and believe me and go get bird A. Knowing the whole time that even while you're hunting for bird A, you're going to be thinking about how tempting that B bird is, not to leave and go get it and not just to stay very disciplined. So that's one of the really fun things about it, I think, is getting to communicate with the dog on the mat as far as, all right, like, I know you want that one, but we're going to get this easy bird right here.
The mutual trust exchange between you two.
Yes. Yes. And mm-hmm. seeing a dog just go, okay, like that. Yeah, I did kind of want B, but if you say A, we're going to get A. And he was, and so sometimes you disagree, and then sometimes you agree, and we're getting A next. Great. That's the one I wanted. We're getting B after that. Perfect. Sounds good to me. And that's kind of how it was on that quad with Fox was we got the duck, then we agreed that next is the hen pheasant. And then after that, we were getting this long retired that was brutal, hip pocket to the long rooster pheasant flyer. And I thought, man, when he came back from the second bird and now we're about to go get this long retired, I thought, does he already have the look? Like he came right back and looked at it. And I thought, gosh, like I kind of want to, you know, step up and I want to push him and pull him a little bit and change his eyes. And then my gut just said, no, he has it. Like he is looking at the bird. And I just went with it, just trusted him, sent him. He just picked up that bird on the fly real pretty, like threw his head in the air, kind of a little show off, flipped his tail in the air, all cute, came running back. And then we got the last one to get, which was the big rooster pheasant flyer. And I always treat that with him like it's the big reward at the end, even though it's not. They're totally exhausted. Hmm. It's the fourth bird. But I always cue him. I go, okay, where's that flyer? Okay. Like, okay, where's that flyer? Okay. Like, now you can relax. And I see him, he does this little deal where he kind of pitter-patters his front feet, I see him start getting kind of loose and kind of pumped. Mm-hmm. And that's the state you want them in to go remember a flyer is like pretty relaxed and loose. So I'm talking to him. Like, yeah, that's it. Okay. Where's that flyer? And I thought, okay, last bird in the 2019 national.
Oh my gosh.
Put my hand in, said his name, and he just charged out there and made one little check a little bit, like under the arc of the bird, and then went right in this bird. Ugh, it had overheated a dog. We'd already had to have a dog like get carried off the line and thrown in the lake and put under care. And the hunts on this bird were just crazy. And he went right out there and knew where it was and came flying home with it. And I was just ecstatic because at that point, I don't know if we win. There's 9 more dogs to run. You don't know anything. The thought is we did our best. If our best wasn't the best of the field today, that's fine. That happens a bunch of weekends. Like where I know that's as good as Fox can do, but but it wasn't, we weren't the best in four series. We were just the best on one bird, or, you know, whatever the case may be. But it's a good feeling to know you left nothing behind.
Right. And put on a fantastic performance.
Yes. And just, and to me, when I'm judging, what I love the most is watching good dog work. Like setting up a test that I know is going to be really hard, and then watching some super talented animal just come up and make it look easy. Mm-hmm. And that's because that's like what I live for, is watching these dogs do what they were talented enough to do. And so when you see your own dog do it and you go, you know, he showed them today that he's a really good marker. And if we were the best marker, great. If we weren't, great. But either way, like that, I would have liked to have judged that performance. That's kind of, you know, you get to see the dog do what they're designed to do.
And did you stay to watch the other dogs that were running, or did you just go take a little bit of time?
I brought him off the line. Lots of hugs with my training group or Marine National group and Glenn. And then I took him on a little walk, just, you know, me and him. And I always say some prayers, just because I'm always praying for safety for the dogs, and I'm praying for us to do our best, and not for an outcome. I don't pray that way. I don't pray to win or anything like that. But I just pray that, you know, that there's a reason that I was given a passion to do this, and there's a reason that I was allowed to be the person that got to stand beside Fox. And I just do some praying and thanking God and petting Fox, and then came back and could finally ate a hamburger. And then I watched the rest of the dogs. Yes. Then I watched the rest. And that's what's fun again about the National, is that it's not like a fourth series where sometimes it can feel pretty icy in the gallery, where people are not happy to see other dogs do well because it means they're less likely to win. But I had a lot of fun watching and cheering for my friends. And there was one dog that I knew it was her, they were going to retire her. That was her last bird to retrieve in a competition. And so we did a big standing ovation for her. And
so cool.
Yeah, just kind of like everybody's exhausted. We've been there for 2 weeks. It's 10 series, and a lot of good sportsmanship on display in the 10th series. So that was, then we waited, and they were deliberating for not that long. It did not seem like it took that long. What took the longest was we had a bunch of no birds, and so that burned up a bunch of time. But after we waited around, you know, it felt like forever, but we waited a while. Then they call all the finalists. First they say, you know, all the dogs that ran the 10th are finalists, because as a finalist, it's almost like a title, not quite, but being a national finalist is a huge deal. So they tell you, they announce that essentially nobody got disqualified. So, you know, all the dogs that ran are finalists, and everybody's happy about that. So then we all put our numbers on, get our dogs, get in a line, and we walk out to the kind of the big, not a stage, but like a staging ground where they're going to do the ceremony, and the table, the blue tablecloth and the flowers and the ribbon and the trophies all set up. The judges are there. They bring you all out one at a time. They go back through and announce the dog's full registered name again. Cause during the week they say, next running dog is number 22 Fox. They'll say that. And then for the first series and the 10th series, they say number 22 field champion, amateur field champion, Bayou Teche swing for the fence, Fox.
So they'll recognize all the titles then.
Yeah. Kind of a ceremonial thing.
Sure.
And then they hand out all the finalist ribbons, and I was the first one in the line because I was the lowest number, number 22. So I was first in the line and all the way at the end. And I was standing there thinking, you know, because I've only stood in a, let's see, I've finished five nationals total and run 12.
Okay.
And
so you've been there before.
Yes, I've been in the finalist lineup. That was my fifth time, which is a huge blessing. And only wow. one other time did I think there was any chance that I could even be in the running. So, and that was with Slider, his dad. Okay. So, and I was sitting there thinking, I can't believe this. You know, he's only 5 years old. We finished a national. This is huge. And I thought, I really didn't even want to think about whether or not I won, because it's so hard to win, and there's so much that goes into it, and there's all kinds of little things that you can't control, and it wouldn't have mattered how hard you trained, and it wouldn't have mattered how good your dog was. Like, I ran at a good time. You know, the lighting was good, the wind was perfect, or whatever. There's so many little things like that that you just hardly dare think about actually it all coming together for a win. But I did know that there were only three or four dogs, maybe three, that were in really good shape, that had done the 10th series and the 8th series exceptionally well. And I knew Fox was one of them. So I was just kind of like, all right. And so typically they say the winner of the 2019 National Retriever Championship is, and there's a, you know, they do the big dramatic pause, mm-hmm. and then they say your number, but they didn't. There's a big pause, and then he said, from Round Rock, Texas. I had this moment where I just was like, who else here is from Round Rock?
Right.
And I think I had this moment of like, well, it's not me. Who else here is? And I remember I just kind of stood there, and then it hit me, and I can't even describe it. It's like, it can't be real. You want to cry. You want to scream and jump up and down. And I did that. I think I bounced around and squeaked. And then I jumped on the ground and wrapped my arms around Fox. And they had pictures.
Did you have them up there with you?
Flattering photos. Oh, yeah, yeah. The dogs,
all the handlers.
Right there,
okay.
With us. Yes,
okay.
Yes.
Cool.
So I very quickly went down and wrapped my arms around his neck, and that's my favorite picture from,
oh my gosh,
from the whole thing, was the moment that I found out, and I got my arm around him, and he's got his tongue on my nose, giving me a kiss. He's like, I don't know why you're grabbing me all of a sudden, but okay. It's a very one of those moments where it was like, I thought, man, Fox, we've been through a lot together. In 5 years, we've done a lot together, and like, mm-hmm. I know you have no idea what's going on right now, but your life, if you only knew how good your life is going to be after this, you're going to get girlfriends, you're going to get trained, your training's going to relax a little bit, like all kinds of good stuff. But
are his ears perked up right now in the background when you look at him?
So he's I've had
girls
my
trees.
Hand on him. Ears way up. Yes. He knows what both of those words mean, actually.
Girls, treats, and birds.
Uh-huh. Oh, yes. Flyers. Yes.
Flyers. I love it. Oh, my gosh. Lauren, you've given me goosebumps several times throughout this, talking about that. I mean, just so cool. So cool to be in that
thanks.
Moment and for you to be able to share that experience. I'm so thankful for being able to hear it. Thank you for sharing it with us.
I'm glad you wanted to hear it. And it's really, really fun to talk to someone about it who understands how hard it is to do well with these dogs, and how the bond that we share with them, it is like so much more than just some animal that we're competing with. And
so true.
That's fun to talk to someone who you know, you've had those moments with your dog where you've gotten chills seeing what you taught them to do, and then they go out and do it. And yeah. And it's, there's nothing quite like it. I don't think there's anything quite as addictive as that.
There isn't. Something that gets your adrenaline going with excitement and nervousness at the same time.
Yes. Yes. Equal parts.
Fright, joy, all of it. It's incredible.
Uh-huh.
So Fox is out of Slider. Slider was your, mm-hmm. your dog. You, did you have the bitch? Did you breed that litter? Or was he your stud puppy?
He was the stud puppy. And,
okay.
Dr. David All, who owned the female, she was a field champion female named Callie. The litter was in Chicago, and, he decided to breed to Fox, and Bill Eckett, again, my mentor, he said, really think you ought to think about keeping a puppy out of this one. Cause he trained Callie. Bill did all of Callie's training. Mm-hmm. And I loved Callie, her temperament and her talent. Just if you could have a female in this game, she's everything you could want. And right. he said that, you know, that I think this is going to be a really good blend with Slider. Mm-hmm.
And I so said, you were okay, able to spend time with her then? You had seen her work before?
A lot, yes, okay. a lot. Okay. Like, since she was probably, when did Bill get her? She was probably, gosh, in fact, Slider and Callie ran derbies together, so she wasn't even two when I met Callie. And Slider mm-hmm. and Callie got second, Slider got second, Callie got third in a derby. Where I was running Slider, and that's where I met Bill Eckett. He came up and congratulated me, and he was running Callie, and little did I know, you know, a few years later, those two would be bred and I would get Fox. But she was I got to see almost her entire all-age career.
Wow, very cool. So what did their pedigree look like? You had field champions. Were they on both sides? Was it something that you could look at the pedigree and know that you were going to get something special from it?
I would say the pedigree, looking at it on paper, you would say, this is going to be really good. It was a line breeding. So,
okay.
So if you can kind of follow this. So you take yeah. Slider. Slider's father is a dog named Chopper. Chopper's father is a dog named Carbon. Okay, and then go to the bottom of the pedigree. Callie's father is Carbon.
Mm-hmm.
So Callie's father is Slider's grandfather.
Mm,
so
nice.
It was a line breeding on Carbon, and that it's not that tight of one, but actually somebody I don't remember who wanted a puppy, and then they looked at the pedigree and said, "Oh, that's a really tight line breeding." And I don't think it's that tight, but. But it definitely worked. They just, they were very, very high octane dogs. That's mm-hmm. for sure.
Did Carbon make a name for himself, or was he?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
He was a national champion. Yeah. He was a national, I want to say amateur champion, as was Chopper, nice. National amateur champion. And then Slider was an FCA FC. Callie was an FC. Callie's mother was an FCA FC, and her father was a national amateur champion.
Wow.
So it was a really, yeah. you look at it and say, that's going to be a good breeding. But then even if you didn't know any of that and you watched mm-hmm. Callie, and maybe I would hope if you watched Slider, you would see those two could make, like, cause Slider was real heady, like very smart in the field. Just, he could get himself. Where if he ended up in the same spot that a bunch of other dogs did where they got lost, Slider could figure out where he was and get to the bird. Like, he just could do stuff that I didn't teach him. Just, he was smart about that. Like, he had a good GPS. And Callie never has a bad day. No pouting, no, you can tell her she's wrong 15 times and she's going to try just as hard the 16th time. And that just lots of talent, lots of go, great attitude, fun to train. And you put those together. If you had known those two dogs, you might have gone, "Ooh, I think I might want one of those."
mm-hmm. So when did you, after you got Fox, then when did you notice that there was going to be something special about him?
Well, that's a good question too. So when I picked him, there were three males that I was choosing from. And I normally, and I'd go with clients to do this. I just went with my training partner to evaluate a fox litter. I have like a whole process, like a temperament testing process that I go through to test puppies, to pick puppies. Hmm. Not that it's, you know, going to be right every time, but it's some good things to look for. Okay. So I was planning on doing that with Fox's litter, and they just took all the puppies out and set them down before I was ready to, like, I have a whole process and I was wasn't really ready to start, and they set them down and they're so cute. I start kind of baby talk. This is all on video, by the way, it's all on YouTube. And I started talking to them, and one of them comes barreling over to me, his little tail going 90 miles an hour. And I'm kind of down on one knee, and he puts his little front paws up on my leg and reaches up as hard as he can to lick me in the face with the tail going 90 miles an hour and the little ears folded down and wiggling and licking. And I was like,
he picked you.
Ooh, I like that. Right. Yep. And I told people, like, so much for science. That's the one I want right there. Like, I take that guy any day. And that's how I picked Fox. But, so
you have a master in animal behavior.
Yeah. And I picked him because he's cute and ran up and licked me in the face. And he was a character. Like, I started playing with him a little bit, and I'm throwing a bowl on the ground, and I'm kind of trying to do some startle testing, and he doesn't care about any of that. And then I start kind of looking at one of the other puppies, and little Fox had run over and found a leash hanging on a hook on the wall, and he was having a wild tug of war with himself with the leash, and then ended up yanking it off the wall and then took off running out of the room and ran away down the hall dragging this leash with him. And I was laughing so hard. My sister was with me, and she goes, "We got a runner. We got a runner." Just taking off. And we're with, like, the vet. We're at Dr. All's big state-of-the-art vet clinic in Chicago. And there's like two vet techs with us. And now there's just like the herd of people, like, chasing little tiny fox, like, running away down the hall with this leash. And I was like, this dog, I mean, if he makes me laugh this much in the first 10 minutes of knowing him, then we could have some fun together. And that actually is kind of sets up who he was pretty well. Cause he was, he has like this, you know, you think of all labs as being friendly, but Fox has this, effervescent, like, person, like, just, he has sunshine and rainbows just coming out of his heart at all times, mm-hmm. is what I like to say. He's just happy all the time. The dog's never had a bad day. A lot like his mom, he loves to work. And so when he was real young, he was kind of a terror, like, in his crate and X pen. When I was teaching him about good manners in there, he was very persistent and being wild and not wanting to sleep and barking and carrying on and all that. But once we got that sorted out, maybe he channeled it into his work ethic, because he loved every aspect of work. He loved basics. He obviously loved marking. He loved drills. If this had been your first dog, you would be spoiled for life, because he was so easy to train.
Easy. Mm-hmm.
Yes, he made it easy. And he was sensitive in the right way. Like, he was not, how do I say this? He was trying to figure out what I was trying to get him to do as hard as I was trying to teach him what to do. Like, so it, almost like we met halfway all the time. Like, if he's trying really hard to figure out the right answer and I'm trying really hard to teach him the right answer, we're going to advance very quickly. And that's mm-hmm. what he did. He just, he did that, just very, very tractable. He would, if he was wrong, he was a little hard to read, because he wouldn't get pouty. He wouldn't slow down. He wouldn't look like he felt bad about it. He would just try something different. And I loved that part of his mind. I love a dog that thinks, okay, so if I went this direction and you blew a whistle, the whistle means you were not going the right direction. If I blow a whistle, no collar, no electricity, just tweet, no, come here, let's try again. And I send you again. Are you going to leave the line looking like you're in trouble? And, now I'm scared to do anything because I'm afraid I'll be wrong again. Are you going to charge right back out there, happy as can be, but go in a different direction? And right. That's what he would do. Mm-hmm. So it made training him and teaching him basics. I mean, I remember a couple of times in basics, I was thinking, gosh, I hope I've conditioned him enough, like collar conditioned him enough and let him understand like how training really works, because he does so much right that you almost wonder, do you know what to do if you do it wrong? Like, are you able to accept Kofax? Are you able to accept criticism and being wrong? Or do you even know you're doing it wrong? So he was just a lot of fun, like all the way through that. And I remember the first time I kind of, my ears went up was when I ran his, I think he was not quite three. And I ran his first open. He'd already run some amateurs and done well, but I ran an open and Danny Farmer pulled me aside. I hugely respect Danny. And he pulled me aside and he said, "You mark my words, that one's going to be better than his daddy." He's like, "That one's good." And I remember thinking, well, you know, that's nice, but Danny doesn't really know. I mean, Danny, I competed with Slider against Danny all the time and all that. But for him to say that, I thought, I don't know about better, maybe different. But I started to hear some things like that and to kind of go, oh.
And how old was Fox at that age when other people started to see it?
Probably before he was three.
Okay.
Like when he started running amateurs, I started getting, well, because I get the first time he ran an amateur, I had run a qualifying on Friday and just had entered the amateur on Saturday, just kind of for fun to see if he was even close to being ready. He had barely turned two. I mean, he had turned two like a week before, and he won the qualifying on Friday and then got third in the amateur on Saturday. And that's like unheard of.
Mm-hmm.
So that it was right around then. So he was barely 2 years old. I guess that was, and I heard a little bit in the Derby, but the Derby is, there's no blinds and it's all marking, and not to take away from it, but there's a lot of dogs that do really well in the Derby and you never see him again. You never hear from him again. They never make it to the all age. So he was a good Derby dog and he certainly loved it. But I think it was that weekend that he got the first in the queue and got third in his first amateur, and then was an FCA FC while he was a 3 year old. That's when I really started to hear it. And of course, Slider had passed away when Fox had just turned two. Yeah, Fox, it was just a little over two, maybe two and a half when Slider died. And so I threw everything I had into Fox, and I started to see things in him that you'd maybe miss if you're training like a really good all age dog, and then you got your young dog. Like, you may not see some of the things in that young dog that you would if that was your only dog. I don't know if that makes sense, but so I started to kind of, you know, I spent all my time with Fox and I started going, man, like this is kind of everything I've ever wanted it to train. Right. Like, this is, I don't have any complaints.
Yeah. It's not typical. I mean, training can do so much with a dog, but to be able to get that package of intelligence, talent, heart, and the trust, to get all that isn't easy to come by. A lot of dogs can have the independence that you want to see of maybe being able to go out and do it on their own. But there's a very fine line for so much of it is what is too much and what's not enough. And it sure sounds like Fox has a perfect balance of all of that.
That is your word there. Balance is so critical. And I don't know that there's a dog game that wouldn't be true for everything you just said, that mm-hmm. when you have a dog who is able to listen to you when he's supposed to listen to you and able to work on his own when he's supposed to work on his own, that's like the Holy Grail. Mm-hmm. And that is, it's so fun too, right? Because you're getting to, you know when you need to help and you know when you need to get out of their way. And that's what makes it so fun. I mean, they can do things that we can't do. I can't mark birds like Fox can. You can't smell and point like your dogs can. Mm-hmm. There's abilities they have that we just don't. Mm-hmm. So there's a point where we have to say, your talent has to take over. And then there's a time when they still have to, with all that ability, they still have to say, if you say so, I'll do it your way. And that temperament, that's definitely the one that's the one I want to train every day. That's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Right. What are your thoughts on, so these dogs that are being bred as highly competitive dogs, are they going to be good for the average owner, whereas a house dog for the hunter that gets out maybe on the weekends, every other weekend? Or is it going to be too much dog for them?
I'd say I've kind of seen that be both. Like I'd say there's some dogs like I think about mine that they're really nice. They're very, very easy to have in the house. But for example, during this coronavirus thing, I've seen them be a little more animated in the house because we're not getting to go out and do as much of what we would normally get to do. So mm-hmm. it kind of makes me wonder if these guys weren't getting trained, you know, three times a week or twice a week and conditioned on other days, would they be holy terrors in the house? Maybe. Mm-hmm. So, I'd say there is a lot to that. Like if someone was going, knew that they were going to pretty much have a hunting dog for part of the year and do a little training here and there, I would definitely say it would be better to go with something that doesn't have a bunch of FC and NAFC and NFC in it. Mm-hmm. You would probably want something that has a little bit more, the breeding was structured more toward family dog. You know, they have desire, but they don't have the nonstop crazy no quit. Like they're happy to go retrieve, but they're happy to be done and come back inside and lie on the couch with you too. Mm-hmm. Like that would be
that perfect on off switch.
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of that, I do say a lot of the on off switch is taught okay. when they're little. Like I don't have, and my mom and dad love to bring over dog toys for all of my dogs, but I don't keep dog toys out because it would never stop. Mm-hmm. So the dog toys are put away and every now and then they come out, but this is for relaxing. We're here. We're calm. When we go out and we get in the truck, go to work time. So if you can, a lot of that is taught from a young age and what you allow them to do, it's kind of like, you know, people talk about sleep hygiene with humans. Like if you go in your bedroom, your bedroom's only for sleeping. Don't read in bed. Don't watch TV in bed. And you'll sleep better if your body associates everything in that room with sleep only. I kind of feel like it's like that with dogs too. If they know when we come inside, we're done. Or when I let you out of the dog box, we go to work. If they know those differences and they can rely on them, I think it really helps create that off switch, even if you have a high roller.
What are you doing outside of competition season to keep the dogs spry?
We have a very small off season in the field trial world. So there's not like months and months where we're off, but because you could run all year long pretty much if you wanted to drive all around the country. But generally during, after the National Amateur in June and before the first trial in the fall is my biggest break. So from mid-June to say mid-October. And in that time, I try to do a lot of conditioning. So keeping the dogs to where they're cardiovascularly fit, their muscles stay toned. I try to make sure that whatever the temperature is outside, that we're doing appropriate conditioning for that, which generally in Texas means it's really hot. And I might be doing some water treadmill at a place that I have near me that I can, I do that a couple times a week with the competing dogs.
Okay.
A lot of swimming, but carefully, because even the water temperatures get pretty hot in Texas summers. And trying to keep them to where their attitude by the time we get back into regular trial and training season stays really high. I'm very big on attitude. So if you insist on training 3 days a week and it's 100 degrees, you will burn out any dog. They will dread it. They will not like it. They won't want to get out of the truck when you get to training. So you have to be cautious about that with the weather. Now during like the winter off season, which is shorter, I like to go back and refocus on drills and do some of the things that help the dogs be competitive, but you don't get much of a chance to when you're trying to run big tests and trying to run trials on the weekends. But you know, things like little handling drills to keep them sharp on their casting, on their initial lines, to keep them sharper on their marking. I usually do a lot more singles in the off season, trying to keep them very, very focused on the bird, not so much worried about remembering three or four birds or complicated concepts, but just very pure, basic marking. So relax, watch that bird all the way to the ground and go step on it. And that helps attitude as well, because it takes a lot of the mental pressure off the dog to just see a single like that. So a lot of that. And then outside of anything training related, I do a lot of hiking and walking with my dogs, where I try to go somewhere where there's no other human around and no other dog, and have them all off leash, or at least just on remote collars if there's anything dangerous around, but to where they can just be dogs and they can go explore, and they kind of stay around me like satellites. Nobody's walking in heel position or anything like that. We're just on. I love spending a day doing that with them. I might bring binoculars and bird watch, which I'm trying to kind of get into, and
fun,
and just let them be dogs. I try to do that every week with them, no matter what's going on. And then more often in the off season.
Very cool. Do you hunt with them as well?
Yes, I love hunting. I wish I could do it more, because normally if I'm hunting, that means I can't be training or trialing that weekend, but I love it. And I've been on a couple of fantastic trips with Fox. I haven't hunted my younger two yet, but Fox was on the cover of Max Prairie Wings. He was the cover model dog during their photographer was on a hunt I was on. And they took some really good pictures of him. And so he made the
very cool,
the waterfowl catalog. Yeah. He loves it. And man, I watching them hunt, when you know what all they can do, and then they just kind of go, oh, and that you see the light come on. Like I saw it turn on for Fox. I saw the second day when he started going, so the only birds that I need to be watching that fly over are ducks. And he could tell the difference between ducks and little gray birds that would fly by. Oh, wow. It was very cool. So cool. And he loved it.
I bet. Do you notice the difference of him working in competitions versus hunting wild birds?
That's interesting too. It's definitely, definitely different. Like I can tell that for one thing, he's wearing a collar when we're hunting. But it's almost like the best, you know, he's also having as much fun as he's having at a trial, even though he's mm-hmm. wearing a collar, because it's like every bird is a flyer, I guess. But mm-hmm. he seemed, when we were hunting, looser than I see him in training or a trial. So, which I liked. I liked him mm-hmm. being more relaxed, and I was looser with him. And both times, after both big hunting trips I went on, I ran a trial, I think either the next weekend I got home or the next, like very little training. And he won immediately after hunting. And since it happened two times in a row, I cannot think that that was just a coincidence. I think right. that the hunt let him focus on watching birds more than white coats. Mm-hmm. So really paying attention to the bird, and it got his mind in a good place.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I loved it. I think people that say a field trial dog can't be a hunting dog or a house dog, I really couldn't disagree any more than I do. I disagree wholeheartedly.
Good. Do you find yourself being a little bit more lax on rules and when you're out hunting with him? Do you let him get away with a couple of things that you wouldn't normally do in training and testing?
I would say not as far as anything about like a line manner would be concerned. So I would not let him, he didn't try it, but I would not let him creep or break in a hunt ever, like never, ever, never. I mean, mostly safety, but mm-hmm. secondly, I don't want that to ever be an option. And of course there's so many very tempting moments to break or creep in a hunt. So it's great training at the same time, but I would never let him get away with that. I think where I would maybe back off on him would be casting, like tightness on a blind. So for example, on one of the hunts we were goose hunting, and there was a cripple that sailed a long way. It was maybe over 400 yards away, and we were in a stubbly kind of cornfield, and I knew generally where it was. And the guide knew generally where it was. And so, of course, normally at the end of a blind, I would never put Fox 50 yards downwind of a bird and just let him hunt it up. But I did that a lot while we hunted, just because, you know, I'm going to put you in a position and the last cast I give you is going to be in the general direction of the bird, but you're going to be downwind. And then I'm going to let you just, and of course, he's out there running circles, getting in the scent and finding it, and then it's a cripple and it tries to fly and he's catching it in the air, and you know, there's all this craziness going on, and I would never let that happen at a trial. But of course that's exactly right. what I want him to do in a hunt. So yeah. for sure on that, but I wouldn't back off on like crispness of a whistle sit. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't let him blow off a whistle in a hunt. Again, that could be a big safety issue and a habit thing I wouldn't want to start. But as far as the casting goes, and as far as the tightness of the corridor of a blind retrieve, all of that would definitely get the bar would be lowered, as mm-hmm. would a probably a mark where, if for example, he saw a bird splash down in the water and I send him for it, and he wind of a dead bird that's floating in the water. If he wanted to go get that dead bird and change course on his own, I would let him do that in a hunt. Mm-hmm. And I would not let him do that in training.
I love that you allow that and do both, because there's a lot of people that don't believe in actually hunting with their dogs that they're competing with, worried that they're going to pick up some bad habits. And yeah. the fact that you're able to take Fox and you saw him with a little bit more jolt after his hunt, that's very cool.
Yeah. Well, I was so surprised, because I thought, well, and I had all these people telling me, well, he's going to hunt short. They all thought, you know, you go from a hunt where the birds are 50, 60 yards away to running an amateur where they're 400 or 500 yards away. He's going to mm-hmm. break down and hunt at 100 yards. Well, of course he didn't. I mean, he knows that the birds aren't 50 yards away when they're, you know, or vice versa. And so that was one of the first things I thought was, why would a dog go hunt? And it's not like they lose their ability to see. he can still see that the bird is 300 yards away versus 100 yards away. So why would he start hunting at 100 yards? And of course he didn't. And then another thing I heard was just like what you said, they pick up the bad habits. And I think if you hunted them, like, and I did, I saw this happen. So this is a friend of mine, and I don't think he'd even mind me telling the story, but he took his dog that was a very, very nice master hunter hunting, and he hunted him hard. But what he would do would be every time he'd send him on a mark, if he didn't go, I mean, if he was offline to the mark by just a few feet left or right, he'd start handling him right away and handle him all the way to the bird. So he developed a popping problem in the dog. Back in the hunt test arena, he'd send the dog on a mark, and as soon as the dog didn't find it, he would turn around and sit because he was expecting to be handled.
Right.
So I think there could be some handler-created habits too, something like that, or allowing creeping and breaking and then suddenly expecting the dog to go back to understanding that you can't creep and break. Yeah. So I think if
there's
got to
be some consistency.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And thoughtfulness as far as, is this something that the dog could take and run with in the wrong direction? Or is this something where I know that I'm letting him go? Like when I'm giving a big cast downwind of the cripple, I know I'm just letting him run around at the end of a blind. But is he really out there thinking that he's blowing me off right now? Or is he just honestly trying to find a bird? You know, so being careful with it, but I see no reason that they can't. And again, like I just said, make them better in both ways. I think there is not a blind retrieve that I'm going to come across in a hunt that Fox can't do, or a master hunter couldn't do, for that matter. They're well advanced of what they're going to come across in a hunting scenario, but there's stuff in a hunt that could really help them in a field trial, just focusing on the bird, for example. So it goes both ways.
Yeah. Laura, do you have a little bit of time for a couple of rapid fire questions I can throw at you?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay, cool. All right. First one, tell us something about yourself that people don't know.
Oh, let's see. Okay. I said it a second ago, I'm an aspiring bird watcher. I want to become a total bird nerd. I want to be able to identify birds by song and sound. And during our phone call, I've been sitting here enjoying watching my lesser goldfinches attend to one of my little feeders in my front yard. So I'm a aspiring bird watcher.
Cool. I love it. I studied ornithology quite a bit in college and spent way too much time.
I did.
I spent a couple months in the rainforest in Costa Rica and a semester up in northern Wisconsin with birds. Yeah, so I have a good book I can send you. It's sitting with dust on it.
I bet you have seen some incredible birds.
Yeah, I wish I had more time to play with that hobby that I used to love and enjoy so much, but things get crazy. Yeah.
You got two little ones too, but
I do.
The dogs. That is really cool though.
It is cool. So I love that you're interested in that, 'cause I got some stuff for you.
Yes, I really am. I really enjoy it. Every day after training, when I went to Missouri, I would get, I'd get a little cup and I'd put a little wine in it. And I get my binoculars and I get the dogs and we go walk and look at birds until it was dark. So I loved
that. Sounds like bliss. I love it. All right. Next one. Name one thing that's on your bucket list.
Ooh, bucket list. Okay. Go horseback on an elk hunt.
Ooh. That's good.
Would love to do that someday.
You're just gonna have to make a trip out here. I'm in Montana, and
oh, you are?
I am. Yeah, we got elk in the backyard. So, and we got horses. I can help you out.
So you got everything.
Well, kinda. We lived in Wisconsin up until 7 months ago, so I'm
I'm exploring all these things, but that's on my bucket list too. It's just now it's actually in a reachable distance than it ever was in the past.
Yeah. Oh, that just sounds so fun to me. Just like, not that I've ever been elk hunting. I mean, there would be a lot I don't know and I would go into it being a student, but it would be really fun.
Me too. Right. Just the packing in and packing out. I've never actually hunted for large game before. So, but when it was time to get a license, we had to do before April 1st. And I unloaded. My husband's like, really? You're planning on hunting these 10 different species? I go, you know what? If there's an opportunity, I'm going for it.
Yeah. Good for you.
Yeah. It's like, you're going to have to come out. Well, we can do that. I can help you with that one, I hope.
Oh, that would be so fun. Okay, that's a deal.
It is. All right, next one. Of all the dogs that you've had, which have you learned most from and why?
Ooh, that's good. Gosh. It'd be hard to say because... You know, I learned about dogs themselves so much from Topaz and Ace, for example. But then I literally would not love training Labradors if I hadn't have had a dog exactly like Steel, who maybe wasn't the most talented dog, but had a ton of go, a ton of heart, and was very forgiving. But then Slider was complicated to train, and I was trying to push him to a higher level than I had ever pushed a dog before. And so therefore it was the hardest training I had ever done. And you run into more challenges because the higher the bar, the more challenges you're going to have, obviously. Mm-hmm. Right. You're trying to train for perfection versus I just want him to sit, you know, it's very different. And he could be a very complicated dog, and the way that he learned and the way that he advanced. So, oh man, who did I learn the most from? I guess I would have to say Slider. Say Slider because I was learning so much about the game and about being a handler and how important the handling was and being the owner, the handler, and the trainer for your first really competitive field trial dog, and the pressure and the expectations, and then of course God's timing to also have that be the only dog where Bill Eckett and I crossed paths. That was perfect timing because I needed him and he really, really enjoyed having a student and working with a dog like Slider or watching me work with him. So we all, like if I had had Bill when I had Fox, I wouldn't have learned as much because in a lot of ways, Fox was easier to train. So it all worked out. And I think I learned the most from all the challenges that I had with it, as a very green field trial handler and trainer and with a dog that could be a challenge himself.
Mm-hmm. The challenging ones just seem like you learn the most from. Because you have to figure out a different way than what you knew before on how to make it work.
Exactly. And and they, you know, if you know they're talented and they're complicated, which was Slider, he was very talented. Mm-hmm. You also are very keenly aware that you could ruin them. And if they get ruined, it's on you. Like you didn't send him away to a pro and he came back broken. If he develops a problem, it's all on you.
Mm-hmm. Yep. If you were to add another breed to your kennel, what would it be?
Well, at this point, it would probably either have to be something that was small and just for fun, or something that could be competitive, because I couldn't do justice to, say, a border collie right now that might be a really great agility or herding dog, because I don't have time. I couldn't do another, mm-hmm. another discipline. So let's see. I would entertain. Well, funny as it might sound, if I were to get a little dog, it would be a Cavalier King Charles Spaniel.
Okay.
Because I enjoy their temperaments, working with a lot of aggression in the last 15 years. I have only seen one in 15 years for aggression. That's probably the only breed I can say that about. Mm-hmm. So I love their temperaments. You know, they've got some health issues. Mm-hmm. So maybe one of those just for fun.
Yeah.
And then if I had to add a different breed that I was also going to try to compete with, it would have to be a very Labrador-like golden retriever.
Okay.
as close to a lab-like golden. My fluffy dog friends will be laughing at that, I'm sure.
All right. What's one piece of advice that you can give to someone new getting into your sport?
Let's see, getting into the sport. One piece of advice, if they were already competing, someone who was about to start competing, my advice would be, go to every field trial that you go to with the mindset of, what great moment did I have with this dog today, no matter what the outcome of the results are, whether I get dropped after the first series or whether I win. Have I been working on line manners? If so, did he sit really nicely and watch the marks in the first series, even though he totally screwed up when he got in the field to try to pick him up? Well, then it was a victory. So count the tiny victories of every trial instead of trying to weigh every trial based on the results only, because it's a losing game. You lose a lot more than you win. So mm-hmm. if you get dropped after the third series, but you know that your dog took a cast in that water blind that you have been working on really hard, and he took that cast beautifully, and you still got dropped, but darn it, he took that cast. You have to go home treasuring that moment, because if you only focus on the results, you'll get real down real fast. And if it was someone who was just getting into even training for it, my advice would be really, really patient with the dogs. We're asking them to do things at a very diamond polished level. And the more patient you are and the more of a teacher you are, the more you're going to have fun, the more they're going to have fun, and the harder they will work for you, rather than if they're afraid to make a mistake.
That's good. Very good. Thank you for sharing that.
Sure. I hope that would help someone. I wish someone had told me some of those things.
Yeah. Where can we find you? How can people get in touch with you?
Well, I'm on Facebook. That's probably the way that I get a lot of Facebook Messenger, and through there I get a lot of people asking, you know, questions about Fox or training questions, things like that. Mm-hmm. And they're always welcome to email me. That's probably the fastest way to get in touch with me. And that goes right through either my company website, which is austincanineconsulting.com, or fox@stud.com with @FOXXATSTUD. And either way, I made both websites, and you can just go right through the link and it goes right to the same email address.
Okay, perfect. Well, I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed talking to you today. Fox is like, wait, I'm not ready to sign off yet.
We got more to say, guys.
She missed a really good part about me being at stud.
he was pointing out that there was also a squirrel outside of it. It was interesting.
What a cool dog. I hope I get to meet him one day.
Oh, I hope you do too. He would love to meet you. He loves to meet people, so he'd love it.
Fun. Well, thanks again for talking to us today and sharing your amazing story and your path and inspiring us. And I hope that we will be able to talk again.
Oh, well, I hope so too. And thank you so much for the opportunity, Courtney. And I love the opportunity to talk to other people that love these four-legged things as much as I do. So I really enjoyed the time with you today.
And good luck and on your new little blessing that's coming.
It's going to be
so many amazing things are going to come into your world that you couldn't have even imagined. And I think you're going to be surprised how well they go right along with the dogs and your sports. And for you to be able to bring up a young outdoorsman or outdoors woman in this industry.
It's a boy. Yeah. But thank you. That's so good to hear. Keep telling me that because I'm nervous.
Yeah. But it'll be good. It's going to be amazing. So all the best wishes and blessings to you and your husband. And thanks again, Lauren.
Thank you, Courtney. I appreciate it. And hopefully we'll get to talk more again soon.
I hope so.
Thank you so much for listening to another episode of the Bird Dog Babe podcast. I'm so grateful you chose to hit play today. If you enjoyed today's episode, please share it with your friends. Subscribe, rate, and review wherever you get your podcast. And if you want to show your love and support of this content, become one of my Patreon patrons. As a patron, you receive more discounts, content, are an insider to the Bird Dog Babe community. In addition, 2% goes towards conservation. If you want to learn more about this episode and others, head over to thebirddogbabe.com for show notes and discount codes from our sponsors. And follow me on Instagram at thebirddogbabe. If there's a topic you'd like me to get after, go to my website and fill out the contact form because this show is for you. Until next time, Bird Dog Babes, keep them versatile.